Back together again, you and I chatting it up, wrapping up a very busy week on Friday, May the 22nd, 2026, right here on Connecticut Today. We talked about Governor Ned Lamont's reaction to an Eversource rate increase request from earlier in the week, highlighting he did the pay structure for the company's CEO. We were also joined by conservative pundit Red Janke from the Red Line blog, Mike Mastroni, founder of the Connecticut Fallen Heroes Foundation, and Quinnipiac University criminal justice teaching instructor Diane Langland-Wartz regarding a recently enacted state law concerning the rights of crime victims in the state.
Well, I mentioned this yesterday because I kind of knew it would happen here because we saw it happen with some of the majority Democrats leadership in Hartford, and now it's been continued by Governor Ned Lamont. First of all, how are you? Happy Friday as we head into the Memorial Day weekend. That coming up more on that later on in the show. Now, Governor Ned Lamont is chiming in to a rate increase request from Eversource. So a bunch of you folks perhaps listening to me now or looking at starting on July 1 of next year, not this year, July 1 of next year, an 11% rate increase. I thought I saw something last night where that would peg out to about $20-something a month for the average Eversource customer, whatever kilowatt hours a month you use, something like 700 is the basic customer. So we're looking at about $20-something a year. $20-something a month, I'm sorry, $200 to $300 a year. I'll get the exact dollar figures on that. But, well, surprise, surprise, surprise on this one, too. And the governor pretty much using the same script as Bob Duff did and some other leadership people did, Martin Looney. And again, look, I'm not saying people can't be upset at rate hikes. I mean, obviously, who wants to pay more when you can pay less? Perish the thought. You can or pay what you're paying. But this story here in the Hartford Courant, and I think you know where I'm going here. Governor Lamont noted that Eversource, which operates in three states, reported a $1.7 billion profit last year. And again, ding, ding, ding. Governor Ned Lamont also taking aim at now, look, before I do this next sentence, if you want to criticize the company's profits and ask openly, well, geez, wait a minute. They say they need all this money for vegetation management and upgrades to its capital projects and everything. All right. But, geez, they made $1.69 billion in profits last year. That wasn't their gross. That was their net. Net after taxes, net after profits, whatever. So if you want to criticize that, I guess you can, right? But again, here we go with how much the boss makes. Lamont also took aim at the company's CEO, Joseph Nolan, saying he, Nolan, took home $13.5 million in salary and benefits last year, an increase of 19%. The governor said, quote, to summarize what's happening here, one of the most profitable utility companies in America, all right, I'll give him that, whose CEO earns 94 times the average worker and walks away with $60 million if the company is sold, is asking Connecticut families to dig deeper to help out their own bottom line. Lamont said this in a letter, apparently, that he issued on this. Now, again, I ask you, who cares how much the boss makes? And when progressives and other people line up against CEO salaries, you do understand that these compensation packages are named and negotiated with the CEO and usually the board of directors, right? Isn't that how this works? So I don't quite understand what the problem is here. If Mr. Nolan or any other CEO, if they come to an agreement with a board of directors that, hey, this will be my yearly outlay in cash, this is what you have to pay me in actual dollars and cents,
This will be what I would like per year in stock options, and I can exercise those when I want or, you know, whatever. You've got to give me a time frame. And if there are any performance bonuses, let's outline that too. So the way I understand it here, and I'm not going to attain any CEO stature here before I get called home to eternal rest. I can pretty much guarantee that. You know, the most I understand here is that these things are negotiated. So if people like Ned Lamont, if people like Bob Duff, if people like Martin Looney are upset here, why don't they ever call out the board of directors or the boards of directors of these companies? But again, they call out the guy or the gal, the CEO or the CFO, whatever, who comes to an agreement with this company or whatever company, or comes to an agreement with the board of directors and says, okay, we're good on this? Yeah, we're good. So you'll give me what I want? Yeah, we'll do it. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Simple question I want to start off with today. Talk or text, and people are already piling on this one. On our Facebook page, facebook.com/voiceofct. Do any CEO salaries ever bother you? Look, as long as the guy or the gal is not going in there literally and or figuratively with a gun to somebody's head, and they come to a gentleman's or a gentlewoman's or a person's agreement, whatever, with the board of directors, who go out there and look for the best bosses to lead their companies and come up with strategies and ways to make things work here. I don't understand the problem here. I don't. So, and again, I'm not taking Eversource's side in this. I'm not. I don't take Eversource's side. I wouldn't take Avangrid's side. I wouldn't take UI's side. No. I'm just sitting here wondering, what's everybody so mad about when CEOs get paid a lot of money? Which, hello, ding, 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 CEOs generally make a boatload of money. Do any CEO salaries bother you? Now, I'm not looking for an answer on a specific salary, but these big CEO salaries, they're big because he or she is the CEO. That's the way it works. And they're hired for their vision for the company, or maybe something that'll drive into the ground. I don't know. You tell me. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. Boys and girls, grandma and grandpa, all the ships at sea from November of 1926, coming up to November here of 2026. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Talking about CEO pay, boss pay, the governor firing back, I guess, in a letter to Eversource. Eversource, we found out earlier in the week, wants an about 11% pay increase. Now, rate increase, rather. Now, if they say 11, that means they figure they'll get 8 or 9, depending upon what Pura allows them. Because they have to allow them something. Well, I guess they don't have to, but I guess they're sitting there going, all right, what are we going to give them here? Because as Eversource correctly points out, they haven't had a rate increase in since an across-the-board increase in 2017 or 2018. And they say, listen, there's inflation. There's stuff we have to pay for. There are all these costs and everything. Now, the governor points out, well, wait a minute. Eversource made about $1.7 billion in profit last year. That wasn't their gross. That was their net profit last year. Now, again, it's a publicly held company, so you've got a fiduciary responsibility to investors here. I get it. But the governor said this. To summarize what's happening here, one of the most profitable utility companies in America, whose CEO earns 94 times the average worker and walks away with $60 million if the company is sold, is asking Connecticut families to dig deeper into their bottom line. Now, a spokeswoman at Eversource, Jamie Ratliff, said earlier in the week that the company's rate increase request would not include any additional money to pay the salaries of the company's chief executive officer, president, or chief financial officer. In response to what Ned Lamont said Thursday, Ratliff said he and other politicians were attempting to sensationalize, and that's in air quotes, quote-unquote, sensationalize claims about the company's salaries, which she said have little impact on customer rates. And listen, that's true. Do you think the $13 million, how much does this guy make? $13.5 million in a company that's worth how many billions? And a lot of that is stock options, too. You think that even moves the meter? Ratliff said in a statement, constant attempts to politicize energy policy and trade on charge rhetoric around electric rates do not serve the interests of customers, nor does it do anything to solve the pressing energy issues facing our state and region. She continued, quote, even if our CEO and other executives worked for free, customer bills would be the same and energy affordability would still be a prevalent conversation in New England as energy supply constraints continue to drive the most volatile and largest part of consumer electric bills. And listen, let me just say this up front, because, listen, you know I would say that I have no stock in Eversource, right? But this old kind of progressive thing about going up, you know, going against CEO salaries, I don't understand. What does it ever? Well, now it's done to make people angry. I get it. I understand it. But man, 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Now, of course, the basic human anger response is going to be, well, the hell with him. He should work free, or he should have his compensation tied to the company's profitability or the performance of the company, which some CEOs do. But like I said, and I'm not trying to blow my own horn here and say what an even-handed guy I am, because I'm pretty much not sometimes. But having said that, who cares what a CEO makes? Even if it's $30, $40, $50, $100 million, if you're involved with a company that's worth billions, that's couch change. But see, there's something else at work here. And I think you know what it is. But there is something else at work here. Part of it's an election year, but again, it's something I talk about all the time. But listen, maybe there are people like a person who just texted me in here. We'll go to that text momentarily, thinking that I'm not looking at it from all the angles here. And they do make an interesting point. We'll go to that text, come back with your thoughts and more at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Red Janke joins us. We have Red on from time to time. Name of the blog is The Red Line, the-red-line.com. Red stuff is always cool and great to read. You can find it at theredline.com. It's also bookmarked by our friend Tom Dudchick on the Capitol Report as well, in his other sections as well. Hey, Red, it's Paul again here. How are you? Good afternoon.
Hey, I'm just fine, Paul. Very good to be with you.
Thanks, Red. Now that I think the dust is all settled, there may be a few flakes still out there. Maybe the smoke has finally been extinguished. Give me your thoughts on what you saw come out of the conventions recently for the Democrats and the Republicans. Red, let's start with the Republicans. It looks like there will be no GOP circular firing squad this year.
Yeah, who would have thought? I mean, just days before the convention, Aaron Stewart hit a major road bump. Ryan Fazio came out with 93% of the delegate vote. He's got a clear shot through to November. He will be prosecuting the case against incumbent Ned Lamont. And then I'm just reading, I Googled to find this out. The last time a sitting governor faced a primary. Josh Elliott, Lamont's challenger, wasn't born yet.
Wow.
So this is a complete flip-flop. The thinking had been that Lamont, a two-term governor, would sail through without a primary challenge and would pick apart Republicans, as you just articulated it, involved in a circular firing squad. He would be lobbing RPGs in from the sideline while Republicans shot themselves up. Exactly the opposite is going to happen. Who would have thought? I mean, really, two and a half weeks ago, it was entirely the opposite outlook.
Does this not, Red, illustrate what's going on? Now, look, I think the governor is still going to win, but does this not illustrate, in your mind, because I've said it numerous times here, you know, the Democratic Party, Red, nationally and here in Connecticut, I think to some extent, while there's still going to be D's in front of the name, there's kind of a grand reset, isn't there? I mean, you look at what's going on with Ned Lamont and Josh Elliott, and you look at the first district race, you look at some of these hyper-local races where you have really progressive candidates going against some long entrenched Democrats in some of these cities. We're in fascinating times, aren't we?
Yes. I think what you're saying could be boiled down to one phrase, which is, I think the Democrats have lost their way.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, they don't know what and who they stand for.
Mm-hmm.
They have the extreme progressive wing, and then they have the likes of Chuck Schumer, who is living in daily fear of AOC challenging him in a primary.
Yep.
The Democrats just don't know what they stand for.
And I'm fascinated, Red, that, and I know it's succulent and juicy and easy to go after Donald Trump. And if I was a Democrat, I'd do that. But, you know, Red, on this program, maybe at least a couple of times a day, 5 days a week, I say, where are the policy ideas? We know you hate Donald Trump. Okay, fine. Good for you. If that's your foundation, good. But, Red, am I missing it, or are they just dearth? Is there a dearth of real policy discussions on their side out there?
There are, and I think they're beside themselves with the realization that Donald Trump is doing what the American people want him to do. He's not behaving the way the American people want him to behave. But it was overwhelmingly the vote of the people in the last election that the southern border be sealed and illegal immigration be cut back completely. Mm-hmm. And Donald Trump is doing that. Now, he's had some policies that have gone perhaps beyond into an extreme that make even some Republicans uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I will acknowledge that.
Mm-hmm.
But sealing the border and drastically reducing, if not eliminating, illegal immigration is exactly what the American people want.
And, you know, Red, I can't wait, and I've said this on the show numerous times, I cannot wait, because you know what's going to happen. We will be into the 2028 cycle. There will be some debate on some network featuring, we hope, a multitude of Democratic candidates, as the early debates always do. And I would just love to hear some network person say, President Trump has made a policy on the border that even longtime border agents say they haven't seen in 50 years as far as how quiet the border is. Red, I pray to God that one of these questioners says, what do you think of that, and will you continue those southern border Trump-era policies? I can't wait to see the vapor lock they go into.
Yeah, and again, one of the astute things that the president did, and he was, you know, uniquely situated to do it, having had a 4-year interregnum when he was out of office, He's only the second president, and he's the only president who really embraced the opportunity. He had 4 years of experience, then he had 4 years to think about it and come back for a second term, and he realized what you need to do is you need to start everything right away, because 4 years is a very short period of time. So insofar as immigration is concerned, having started immediately, what will be the case in 2 to 3 years at the end of his term and as the next presidential election campaign is underway, the southern border will be very quiet. It will not only be sealed. And the deportations will be over. And it will be a very settled status quo. There will be no horrific scenes such as in Minneapolis for the Democrats to point to. It will all be a settled matter because he embraced it day one and attacked the issue day one. And by day 1200, whatever it is, 4 years works out to, I'm not going to do the mental math to the last digit. The southern border and the immigration system is going to be in a very, very settled and well-working configuration.
And it'll be, go ahead, finish up, Brad.
It won't be controversial.
It
won't be controversial.
Yeah, and my sense is a lot of people still to this day who are in favor of that are being a little on the quiet side. The name of the blog is The Red Line, the-red-line.com. Red Janke has been the guest. Red, appreciate it, and we'll chat again down the road. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Paul. Let me leave one last thought.
Sure.
Vermont's approval ratings are sagging.
Yeah.
I'm not so sure that we don't have an opportunity here.
Well,
we being Republicans.
Yeah, we'll see. Red, and you know, 48% last survey, we saw that. Red, be good. Appreciate it, sir. Thanks.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Red Janke. Check it out. The Red Line with use of hyphens, theredline.com. Now, of course, this Monday is Memorial Day when we honor those who gave the ultimate sacrifice, losing their lives while serving in this country in any one of our armed forces. And Mike Mastroni is on the phone here. He's the founder of the Connecticut Fallen Heroes Foundation. And an apt time, Mike contacted me over the past few days, said, hey, can I come out and talk about what the organization is doing, who they are, how they're involved in something coming up big in September. So, Mike, good afternoon, sir. Glad you were able to join me. How are you?
I'm doing good, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Not a problem. Tell the folks who may not have heard about your organization, Mike, what is the Connecticut Fallen Heroes Foundation?
Well, it started off in 2005 with the death of a young Trumbull soldier, Private Cheyenne Seymour. She went to school with my daughter. My daughter came home crying. So I rallied the boys at Sikorsky, and I told them, let's do something for them. We're having a softball game anyway at the Seaside Park. So we honored the young 18-year-old soldier. And then it just kind of grew after that. Now, this September 2026, will be up to 90 fallen heroes that we've given portraits, our very own sculpture, and handmade quilts to each of the families. 90.
So you didn't think, Mike, that this would go on past maybe honoring that fallen hero that your daughter was so broken up about? Did you think this was going to be a one and done?
Oh, yeah. I had no idea. I had no idea. But then there was another soldier from Bridgeport that was killed in a house fire down on his base in Shaw Air Base in South Carolina. And I got a hold of the mother, Wanda, and we honored him at our softball game. But then the following year is when the three soldiers were all killed from Connecticut in like 1 week. Medeiros, Johnson, and Pearson.
I remember
Pearson
that.
Pearson was a Marine.
Yeah.
Johnson was also a Marine from Enfield. And Nick Medeiros was a private. He got killed from an IED, stepped on. And then, of course, 2003, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 was the Operation Iraqi Freedom,
right
into Enduring Freedom, and we've honored many of those soldiers that were unfortunately killed over there.
What do you hear, Mike, when you encounter and talk to the families after they tell you about their fallen heroes? You must hear some amazing things from these parents and loved ones when their lost loved one is honored by your folks.
Yeah, I sure do. Well, it's really heartbreaking. It really is. They tell me stories. They show me pictures and how he was killed. And, you know, the mailman came over with his helmet.
Oh.
Full of tears. But IEDs and small arms, sniper fire, those were the biggest ones back then. Mm. But we also got killed on duty. People wanted to realize that so many soldiers from Connecticut are killed on duty, either in car crashes or some freak accidents.
Yeah.
But you know what? We got something real special this September. We've got a soldier that was killed in World War II from Bridgeport, Connecticut. He was only 19 years old, Sergeant Jack Zarifian. His family lived on Noble Avenue. They matched up the DNA with his sister, who was 96 years old. She's since passed away in 2024.
Yeah.
So I got the nephew with the niece coming in from Rhode Island, and we're going to be honoring the sergeant. He was hit with a missile crossing a field in Germany. They were almost at the end of the war, and they were digging up a highway, I guess, in 2024, and they came across his Harding High School ring.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, they match it. You know, they have a special group that matches up DNA when they can. There's over 80,000 missing in action still from World War II. A lot of them from the Pacific. You're not going to find them because they were in the Navy. They went to the bottom. It's unfortunate they went to the bottom. But a lot of them are still buried over there, and they were never found. In Netherlands and Belgium, Germany, at the end of the war.
Mm. So this will be, and we might as well tell folks about it now, coming up Memorial Day weekend. This way they have plenty of time to plan. Mike, on the 26th of September, September 26th, doors open at 10 a.m. This is the 22nd annual Fallen Heroes Tribute. What's going to happen and where's this going on?
It goes on at Holiday Hill. At one time, we used to cook for everybody, but then we found it was too much work.
Yeah.
You know, renting grills and buying hot dogs and hamburgers and cook. We keep everything free.
Okay.
So now in Holiday Hill, we just pay them. It's $25 a person.
Okay.
You don't have to make a donation. It's free. Come in, you eat breakfast, you eat lunch, and they come out with a beautiful spread. And everything's free. Then we have a ceremony about 1:30. State Senator Tony Wong comes every year.
Okay.
He's a good friend of mine.
Yeah.
And we do a little ceremony. We do some singing, and we have a band sometimes, a DJ. But once we hit the ceremony, we speak about the three fallen heroes. Sometimes we add veterans in there, but this year we don't. We don't have any veterans that we're going to honor. Just these three fallen heroes. Specialist Wayne Gunther was killed on a head-on collision in Fort Sill, Oklahoma, by a mail truck. Yep. And then Sergeant Thomas Ty, 21 years old, from Milford, he was killed on a landing zone in Vietnam when a rotor blade hit him in the head.
Oh, my God. Oh, jeez.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Connecticut, in Vietnam War, Connecticut's a small state.
Yeah.
612 young men were killed.
Amazing.
From Connecticut, from Vietnam.
Yeah.
In Operation Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom, it was about 65 or 66, which is enough.
Yeah.
But for a small state, can you imagine how many fallen heroes were from Texas, California,
oh my God.
New York?
New York. Oh,
Vietnam.
My God. Oh, my God. So once again, folks, this is coming up at Holiday Hill in Prospect, Saturday, September 26th. The doors open at 10. It's the 22nd annual Fallen Heroes Tribute. For information on this and whatever this group does, the great stuff they do, go to ctfallenheroes.org, ctfallenheroes.org. Mike Mastroianni. Mike, thanks. We'll definitely have you on. Remind me before this happens, and we'll have you on to pump it up again. Mike, thank you.
I will. Thank you for having me. God bless America.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate that. All right. Of course, the legislative session ended a couple of weeks ago. What was in it as far as new or updated laws concerning various criminal activity in the state, criminal justice proposal, maybe victims' rights, too? Joining us right now to chat about that in the 5 o'clock hour, Quinnipiac University criminal justice teaching instructor Diane Langland
warts. Diane, hi, it's Paul here at WICC. How are you?
I'm well, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for offering the time today, Diane. We appreciate it. So in the landscape of victims' rights, criminal justice, all the different things that we talk about all year in Connecticut, what are some things that you think my listeners should know regarding where we're going now that the legislative session has kind of toned down here? What made news?
Well, the thing that I think that is most important for crime victims and survivors is Public Act 26130. Mm-hmm. There's a section in that Public Act, Section 9, which makes some significant changes to establish greater uniformity across the state by strengthening accountability for victim notification and ensuring that victims are given a meaningful opportunity to address the court at critical stages of the criminal justice process. Namely, victims of crimes have historically been notified when plea agreements are happening mm-hmm. and at the time of sentencing, and they've had the opportunity to make statements to the court at those times. And now that's been expanded so that victims have the right to be notified mm-hmm. and provide input concerning dismissals and nollies.
So previous to this time, Diane, if a case was going to get nollied or dismissed, are you saying, are we to understand that maybe victims or their families or whatever, or business owners who were tagged here, they weren't told about this at all? Or was there a minimum sort of standard or not?
They did not have to be told at all. What's interesting about that is it really sort of depended on what jurisdiction one was in, who the prosecutor happened to be, whether the victim was notified or not. Some prosecutors, as a matter of courtesy, would reach out and let victims know, and others didn't seem to think that that was necessary. So now we have uniformity. Now this is law. Now the prosecutors have to be letting victims know. They have to notify them, and they have to let the court know that they notified the victims. I should point out that this doesn't apply to victims of every single crime,
okay.
But it does apply to victims of sexual crimes and family violence crimes.
And what you just said, Diane, about the inconsistency, I guess would be the word as far as individual prosecutors. I mean, me, the common person here and my listeners, they must hear that and are kind of, I don't know, shocked, disappointing that there would be kind of this leeway previously that now we've attempted to close here at least.
And they should be shocked.
Yeah.
And I think what happens is that most people didn't realize that this gap existed mm-hmm. unless they were in a situation where they were the victim of a crime and they found out after the fact that a case got nollied or dismissed.
And that is interesting because I can imagine, Diane, the shock, the stress, the emotional toll that some of these crimes put on people, and then to be kept in the dark about this, at least by some of the prosecutors and attorneys that you mentioned, thankfully not all of them, but to have been kept in the dark about this, I mean, it must have been, I can only imagine, we've had some violent crime hit my family, so I know what it's like. It had to be almost like a gut punch thing to some of these people, I would think.
I absolutely agree, and I can tell you from personal experience
sure.
That my family, too, has been impacted by violent crime, mm-hmm. and that's exactly why this change came about. I've worked in the field of victims' rights for over 25 years. My husband's been in the field even longer. And we knew that there were gaps in services, but it wasn't until violent crime touched our family that we realized that we really needed to make a real and meaningful change. And so a few years ago, we sat down with the laws in front of us and a red pen in hand and started writing out the changes that we wanted to see happen. And we were able to finally bring them to the legislature and get this change made. It's a step in the right direction. I think that there are still, there's a long way to go, but I'm pleased to see that our legislature is in a place right now where they really are balancing, looking at changes that will benefit offenders and hopefully strengthen their ability to reform. And they're also balancing that with looking at the rights of victims and survivors and their families, so that we can have really we can strike a balance. That's what our criminal justice system really should be. It should be about balance and accountability.
Yeah. Finally, Diane, what do you think still has to be done? You just said a couple of seconds ago we're getting better. Give me one or two points in about the minute we have left as to what you want to push maybe for the next legislative session.
I would like to see stronger laws in effect for restorative justice, specifically for juvenile offenders. I think that juvenile offenders, many, most of them have a great potential for healing and accountability. But I think we need to have stronger laws in place prior to their cases being adjudicated so that we make sure we're getting the proper services for them. And if we're doing that, I think that victims will feel safer. Victims want to feel safe. They want to be heard and they want to know what's going to happen next. And I think that if we can strengthen laws around those three things, that will be a huge step in the right direction as well.
Diane Langland Wartz, Quinnipiac University criminal justice teaching instructor, on some good things that have happened and hopefully more to come as far as victims' rights and criminality in the state. Diane, thank you. We appreciate the time. Take care, and I'm sure we'll check in down the road. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Paul.
All right, there you go, and you'll be able to hear that and maybe share that with family members who've been touched by crime. So good stuff done, but still, as she said, still some good stuff to come.